This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. And coming up in the second half of today's show, we talk about mental health. But we are going to start today with a reality TV show, a competitive cooking show. Now imagine the stress of competing on a cooking show, complete with celebrity judges and timers and a film crew capturing your every move. Now imagine you're not told what to make, but you have to figure it out based on clues left in the kitchen. The detective and baking show genres are combined in Crime Scene Kitchen, which airs Wednesdays at 8 o'clock Central on Fox. Two contestants are originally from North Dakota. Thomas McCurdy now runs a farm in Vermont, appears on the show with his mom, Kathy Jacobson, of Devil's Lake. Thomas, thanks so much for joining us today.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having us.
Kathy, thank you for joining us today.
You bet. Nice to be here.
So, Thomas, I gather you are on this listserv, kind of like a mailing list. You responded to a call out for people who like to bake and solve puzzles. And now you're competing on a national level TV show with your mom. I'm sure I missed a couple of steps in there. Fill us in. What else happened in between listserv response and casting?
Yeah, I mean, that's all I can really remember. It happened so fast. I receive emails regularly from various casting agencies that are casting all sorts of shows for all sorts of projects, and very rarely are they of interest at all. But one came through the inbox a few months ago that was really quite vague. It just said, are you a professional baker or a skilled home baker who enjoys puzzles and solving mysteries? If so, inquire within. And so I submitted, I filled out the little questionnaire expressing interest. And before I knew it, I was on a plane on my way to meet my mom in LA to begin this adventure.
And your mom, Kathy, you were originally hesitant. You said no. What changed your mind?
I said, no, I don't think so. If you want to win this competition, you could probably better choose someone else, because I am not a professional baker. I slept on it overnight, and I kept thinking it's the things in life you don't do that you regret, not the things you do. And so when he called me a couple days later, he said, Mom, really, would you reconsider being on the show? Reconsidered, I'm in.
I love that. I was able to watch episode one, and Kathy, you call yourself a meat and potatoes kind of cook. And Thomas, you mentioned right away that they were looking for professional bakers or skilled at-home cooks. Thomas, where does your mom need to give herself more credit than that meat and potatoes cook line she threw out there?
Oh, my mom doesn't give herself nearly enough credit. And when we were talking about going on the show and she wasn't sure, I asked her, I said, okay, Mom, other than me, do you know anyone else in your entire orbit who knows more about baking than you do? And she said, well, no. she is an incredibly skilled cook and baker, and she's always trying new recipes, making various cakes and pies and cookies and treats, and she's so skilled in the kitchen. I knew that she had what it takes. I know that she has what it takes, rather. And I would say that my weaknesses in the kitchen, or areas where maybe I don't have the most experience, would be hers. You know, my mom has this whole lifetime of countless hours spent in the kitchen making all sorts of desserts and goodies from her mother or her grandmother's recipes, from all the places that she's lived. And so I have the professional training and the restaurant pastry background, but she has this whole depth and breadth of knowledge that I do not. So I knew we'd be a great team.
And how is that working for you? Because, you know, moms are used to being the ones in charge and being the authority figure. And now here, Kathy, you have had to switch roles a little bit. You're still mom, but he is the professional. Are there some, I don't know, are there some little hiccups there in learning to work sort of for and with instead of just being the boss?
You know, people must seem to think that the role reversal of the bossy pants is really kind of unusual here, because we got asked that a lot in California. Huh. But I had no problem at all letting Thomas take the lead on this. Thomas has all these compartments in his mind, and he's just thinking all the time, and he knows so much that I just totally let him take the lead. I had no problem at all with that.
Well, let's talk about how the show works. It's called Crime Scene Kitchen, and it airs Wednesdays at 8 o'clock Central on Fox. And, you know, the viewer at home, there are these moments where they're going to build in suspense, where they hold the shots extra long, where they turn up the music, you know, and then they're going to cut to commercial. You're not hearing any of those things. What's it like to be on set when they're building the suspense for a competition show? Thomas, you go ahead.
Yeah, well, I would say that the suspense, the excitement, the drama is all very real. It doesn't feel fabricated or built at all. The timer on the clock is very real.
Yeah.
The mysteries that are thrown at us are real. And so in the moment, it's exciting. It's nerve-wracking. Time flies by. It's so much fun. But really, in that moment, when it's time to bake, I'm only focused on what's in front of us and the task at hand. And there might be a whole sea of camera people and show people right in front of me, but I'm only focusing on what I'm baking. And so it was exciting, it was fun, and I really loved it.
Kathy, do you have TV experience? Thomas has won an episode on the Food Network of Chopped Sweets.
I have no TV experience at all. You know, I used to work for a bank, and I wrote the radio ads, and I would record the radio ads for the bank. So that's as close to stardom as I have ever been.
How do you like being on this side of it?
It was such an experience. It was an experience and an opportunity that I don't think Thomas and I will ever forget. And like Thomas said, you don't need the music and the waiting to build up the excitement. For me, the most interesting time and the most dramatic time was standing on those steps and watching the different teams bring out their desserts and thinking, did we get the right one? Oh, maybe we got the wrong one. And just waiting for that mystery dessert to come out of the smoke. I mean, that was really suspenseful for all of us.
I would agree. I would echo that. You can maybe tell from watching the show that it's this big, beautiful set with six completely separate, fully equipped kitchens all sort of facing the same direction. And so the viewers and the judges can look and see everyone working at once. But in the kitchen, when we're baking, we can't see the other bakers. We can't hear them. We have no idea what anyone else is making. And so it's not until teams are called up to present their desserts to the judges that we have any idea what anyone else has made and how they've interpreted the clues. And maybe they found clues that we didn't. And so that really is probably the most fun part of the show. Yes. Seeing what others made and just evaluating our own dessert against theirs.
Let's talk about that evaluating the clue part. So Crime Scene Kitchen, yes, you are thrown into this kitchen where a dessert has been made. They don't tell you what, but there are some clues, what spices have been used, you know, how many eggshells or what have you. And then you have to look around the kitchen, figure out what's been made, and then make it. And, you know, episode one, there were, I think, six teams making five different desserts. They came to five different, mostly logical conclusions. What was your process for how to figure out these clues?
Well, I'll say going into the Crime Scene Kitchen for the first time, we had absolutely no idea what to expect. In terms of these clues, we had no idea what we were looking for. And so that was so exciting and so challenging, looking through the cupboards and drawers, the dishwasher, the refrigerator, freezer. There are bits of crumbs or flour on the counter, items in the garbage to indicate how to decorate. Or there might be, yes, one of the jars of spices on the spice rack with the lid slightly askew. And so the first step is really just finding all of the clues, or at least trying to. And then the second part of that is interpreting them, evaluating the clues to figure out which are pertinent to this bake and which were left here to mislead us, because some of them might have absolutely nothing to do with the dish that we're making. But we found both my mom and I are the type of learners in which saying it out loud will help us remember it. And so we realized right away that just thinking out loud and talking to each other the whole time that we're in that kitchen, I'm seeing this, it could be this, I'm opening the fridge and here's what I find, we're more likely to remember it when we walk out of the kitchen.
So, Kathy, how is this experience going to change how you cook? Will it?
Oh, I think it will definitely change how I cook. Realize it's totally different when you're under the clock and when you're cooking, baking something for judges. There were a few times where I just had to start over again. I mean, yeah, my home company, yeah, good enough. But when you've got these professional judges evaluating what you're baking, you really have to be perfect. And when you're looking at the clock, you can't say, oh, I'll do that later, or I'll come back to that and reevaluate. You're constantly under the gun. But as far as my own baking, I'm going to continue to bake things that I've never baked before that are totally out of my comfort zone. In fact, I plan on having some friends over in the near future where we're just going to have a high tea and I'm going to bake all kinds of exotic things I've never baked before, just because it's so fun and so delicious.
Well, let's talk about this recipes you've never baked with before, because there's reading a recipe. And then there's coming up with a recipe, and then there's not having any idea what you're supposed to be baking and sort of making it up. Or I mean, I don't even know how that works. If somebody said, okay, looks like they made, that French wedding cake made out of profiteroles, the croquembouche, like, now where do I start? Do you, Kathy, have experience making up recipes?
You know, I am such a let's follow the recipe person. I will try any recipe. If someone says, oh, Kathy, I really love such and such, okay, I'll make it for you. I have no problem following a recipe. But that's another thing about this show. I think it's going to help me become a little bit more creative in the kitchen. And I love that. I love being able to say, okay, this is what I think would be really good. Okay, let's put it together and make it.
Thomas, do you have a Rolodex in your head, basically, of recipes?
Baking is very much a science, and so different from cooking, in which you can throw a little bit of this, a little of that, and you have a salad. But with baking, it really is chemistry. You know, in pastry, we often use the word formula instead of recipe, because these are basically, you know, chemistry experiments. And there are only so many ratios and you know, formulas that one can have in their head. And so this experience was really quite challenging, but a great exercise for me in just trusting myself and trusting my gut, because when the clock is ticking, there's no time to second guess oneself. And you know, our little brainstorming session on the show, when we're evaluating the clues that we found in the crime scene kitchen, that happens while the clock is ticking and our bake is being timed. And so we need to decide very quickly what to make, and then we need to make it as quickly as possible. So I think for me, one of my greatest challenges, just professionally and personally, is just leading well enough alone. I'm a perfectionist to a fault.
Right. Pastry chef. Come on.
Exactly. But with this experience, I had to force myself to let go a little bit and just trust myself, trust my mother, trust the process, and just get it done the best we can. And at least in episode one, it paid off.
That's not an easy mindset to get into. I mean, the skill set that got you to the level that you are at, all of a sudden it's just like, you're gone. You worked a whole lifetime to build these perfectionist skills. What do you still want to kind of hold on to?
What makes this show different than any others that I've seen is that it's not about making the best dessert or the most beautiful, most delicious. It's just about making the correct dessert. And so in the first bake of episode one, I would never, ever put a spider web on the top of a Boston cream pie or coat the sides of it with sliced toasted almonds. And so I really had to go against, you know, everything that I held near and dear as a pastry chef, and the aesthetic that I maintained, just the types of desserts that I'm comfortable and experienced creating. I had to let all of that go and focus on, no, what's the correct dessert? Not what do I want to make, but what am I supposed to be making right now? And it was a lot of fun, and it was such a great exercise for me that I hope I can keep some of that mindset with me, after the show and in my everyday life, because I could benefit from relaxing just a little bit and letting go.
In addition to being on this national TV show, you run a farm with your husband during the pandemic. You switched it over almost immediately to a delivery service of fully prepared meals, which in theory is great for a chef, but you're missing that element of seeing people. What's your next step, Thomas?
That's exactly right. My husband and I have been farming for 10 years now. We have a cut flower farm up here in northeast Vermont, and we also raise some beef, pork, and poultry just at a homestead level. And for the past 7 years, I've had a bakery operation, baking for farmers markets, doing wedding cakes, and had a mail order Christmas cookie business. And yes, it was March of 2020, the arrival of COVID. I transitioned everything over to a meal and prepared food delivery service, thinking, okay, for maybe 2 or 3 months until this COVID thing is behind us, this will be great. But then it was a year later, suddenly spring 2021, and it was still going strong. I'm so grateful that we were able to create this new business and create some jobs and feed so many people through 2020. But to be honest, I just got really tired, and it was time to step back. And you're exactly right that as much as I love to cook and bake and to create food, for me, it's really about sharing it with people and enjoying it at a table with friends and family and customers.
Yeah.
And so just making food and dropping it off on someone's doorstep, I realized wasn't as fulfilling and enriching as I would have liked it to be. So we've taken a step back, and this summer I'm just on the farm, helping in the greenhouses, raising some animals, growing veggies, and the plan is for next summer, 2022, to resume our brunch and dinner events that we have here on the farm. We have a beautiful little event barn in which we've hosted a number of events in the past. I'd love to share this space and my food and our flowers with people here on our farm. It brings me so much joy. And so we're in the process of constructing a commercial kitchen space here on the property so we can really focus on bringing people here, sharing the space, and enjoying meals here on the farm.
Kathy, that kind of approach to food can be just something someone is born with, and who knows where it came from. But in this case, it's pretty obvious that he was raised in an environment of deep appreciation for the kind of connection that can be built over food. When you're not cooking on a national TV show, what's your approach to setting the scene, creating a mood, having the food and the love and everything that you put into a meal get out there to your guests?
I love bringing people together through food. I have been working at Lake Region State College in Devil's Lake, and when I started there, it was really important to me that we celebrated everyone's birthday. Mm-hmm. And by just getting together and celebrating birthdays within the nursing department, it's just really brought that group of women so much closer together. And on a more personal level, I just love creating events for my friends to enjoy. I think that it's the ambiance, you know, whether it's a backdrop of a French bistro, which, yes, I have done, or candelabras and special invitations or menus on the table. I love to create an experience, and I think that everything together, including the food, is making memories. And I think Thomas will be the first one to say and to acknowledge that I'm constantly saying, let's make a memory. And that's what food does.
Thomas, did you get to meet the woman for whom your farm is named? Because your husband started this farm in memory of, was it a grandmother?
Yes, it was my husband's late grandmother, Ardelia. She passed away at the age of 98 about 8 years ago, and I unfortunately did not have a chance to meet her, no, but we left Philadelphia to start farming. It was 2011, and we were on rented land for a couple of years, just learning about this new life that we had chosen. And then when Ardelia passed away, she remembered her grandchildren in her will, and it was that gift that allowed us to finally invest in some land ourselves and buy what became Ardelia Farm. She was a wonderful gardener and flower enthusiast and a skilled cook, baker, and hostess, and so it seemed only fitting that our food and flower-based business be named after her, and it's also such a beautiful name.
And that investment made it possible. Winning something like Crime Scene Kitchen gets a person $100,000, or I guess a team $100,000. I know you can't tell me if you won the series, but can you tell me what $100,000 would mean to Thomas McCurdy and Kathy Jacobson?
Well, I retired from my job on April 1st, and I flew to California to film the show on April 2nd. And so if I were to win my portion of $100,000, I would spend it traveling to all of the places that I have only dreamed about. I love to travel, but face it, we do not have unlimited budgets to spend traveling. That is what I would do with $100,000.
Thomas?
Yeah, so my husband and I bought our farm in March of 2014, and it's a beautiful 50-acre piece of property up here in, yeah, again, the northeast corner of Vermont. Beautiful, but it's a rickety old dairy farm that was in the same family for many, many years and then neglected for quite a few before we purchased it. And for the first several years of our time here, we invested everything that we could into the business, building greenhouses, amending the soil, buying a tractor and skilled labor. And we're finally at the point with the business and the farm that it's time to shift gears a bit and focus on the house and making things a bit more beautiful. And so we just finished tearing down a good portion of the rickety old dairy barn that was about to fall over. It just needed a little help, and we would love to be able to restore what remains of the original structure from around 1900. And our little farmhouse, we've been slowly fixing up from the inside out, and it'd be wonderful to win half of $100,000 to continue to restore this beautiful old farm.
Thomas, I think North Dakota farm. I'm thinking plaid. I'm thinking dusty boots. I'm thinking about wheat. And then I think Vermont farm, New England farm. I'm thinking more fitted clothes, and I'm thinking cheese. Am I way off on either of these?
I mean, we certainly have dusty boots and big old tractors, but I will say, yes, growing up in North Dakota, I had one idea in my head of what farms looked like.
Yeah.
That's all that I knew. And so moving to New England and being a part of this completely different agricultural landscape has certainly opened my eyes to what farming can be and is. And so our farms are much more hilly here in Vermont. We have quite a few trees, and you really need to take advantage of those little bits of flat ground that you do have. So there might be a greenhouse tucked away here or there, and a little paddock over there with a couple of cows grazing, and a cute little old barn. And it's a lot of work, of course. It's not nearly as bucolic as it looks on social media, but it is really dreamy, and it's so easy to take for granted that we really are living the dream here, and I feel so fortunate.
Thomas and Kathy, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you. Pleasure.
That was Kathy Jacobson and Thomas McCurdy, a mother-son team competing for a $100,000 prize on Fox's Crime Scene Kitchen, which airs a Wednesday at 8 o'clock. You can find out more about Ardelia Farms on Facebook and Instagram. Still to come on Main Street, a discussion with former Congressman Patrick Kennedy. But now, the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. One of the studies lawmakers will do in their 2021-2023 interim will be of space needs for state government, and a part of that will include which state employees continue to work from home. The COVID-19 pandemic meant a number were working remotely, and Governor Burgum has suggested for some that may continue.
It's certainly from data that one reads, that is the wave of the future. We might not like it, or individual legislators might not like it, but you better embrace it because that's the direction we're probably going.
Grand Forks Republican Senator Ray Holmberg chairs the Legislative Management Committee. That committee will assign the studies to the interim committees.
One of the big questions is the amount of service. Does that reduce the service to the citizens? And if it does, then it's probably not worth it. But if the service is the same, who cares if the person is wearing their slippers in the middle of the workday if they're getting the job done?
That study will also look at whether some state officials or legislators rent space to state government agencies. COVID-19 vaccination rates have slowed across the country, and that may leave local populations vulnerable to COVID outbreaks. Health experts say doubts and hesitancy about the vaccines have sharply divided the country. Michael Osterholm is the head of the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy at the University of Minnesota. He told NPR in many places the pandemic is effectively over, but not completely.
We will start to see over time increases in regional outbreaks, in local community outbreaks that will stress the healthcare systems. This is not over with yet. And I think that part of it is, you know, if I went back to last June, everyone would say we were done then. And then look what happened.
Osterholm says variants like the so-called Delta version spreading in the UK shows the virus still has the ability to adapt and spread. And a new statewide program in Minnesota aimed at combating catalytic converter theft is included in a budget bill that will be voted on in the upcoming special legislative session. It sets new requirements for tracking sales of the emission devices to scrap metal dealers. It contains a $400,000 pilot program for marking catalytic converters on vehicles most prone to that kind of theft. It would be at no cost to the owner. DFL Representative Zach Stevenson of Coon Rapids says existing converters do not come marked.
If your catalytic converter was stolen and police found a catalytic converter in a pile, you know, a month later, they'd have no idea, a way of knowing it was yours or that it was stolen.
Police have reported catalytic converter theft has become an epidemic. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. The pandemic has put a bright light on a lot of gaping holes in our healthcare industry, including that of mental health services. Former U.S. Congressman Patrick Kennedy is the founder and CEO of the Kennedy Forum, an organization dedicated to improving mental health and addiction services. He co-sponsored the 2008 Mental Health Parity Act, and in this excerpt from the Conversations on Healthcare podcast, he talks about the toll of the pandemic on mental health with hosts Mark Maselli and Margaret Flinter.
Congressman Kennedy, welcome back to Conversations on Healthcare. It's been quite a few years.
My pleasure.
You know, you've called the COVID-19 really a watershed moment for mental health. It increased the unmet mental health and addiction needs, increased depression, anxiety, overdose. Just put this in context for our listeners.
Well, it's hard to imagine where healthcare doesn't include mental health care when we know of the neurobiology behind depression, anxiety, addictions of all kinds, schizophrenia. We know these are all biological, heavily genetic mm-hmm. illnesses, yep. just like other illnesses. And because of the shame and stigma around mental illness and addiction, we've never created a movement like breast cancer, AIDS movement. There's just been no public advocacy to speak of when you think of it in relationship to the fact that it affects every single American. And the pandemic clearly, I think, brought us out of the closet because everybody could identify with what mental health meant after the pandemic mm-hmm. because everybody was affected either directly or through their family directly. The anxiety, the dislocation. There's just an awakening right now. It's kind of a moment of clarity is what we say in recovery, you know, where I think as a nation, we finally come to the realization that we have been in denial because the real characteristic of mental illness is the failure to have insight into your illness. I've been in active addiction most of my adult life. I never understood how dysfunctional, how ill I was. Mm-hmm. And of course, we all know about the enabling that goes on around us with all of our friends and family. And in essence, it takes them hostage too, because once someone around you is suffering, you're suffering too. Mm-hmm. And we're spending one-fifth the amount of money as we dedicated to fight HIV/AIDS. So, and I can tell you, as a member of many who are on the front lines, we haven't barely scratched the surface of tackling this illness. And it's all seen through the prism of the money. And it's the famous words, if you really want to know where someone's priorities, follow the money. And the money has not come into this space. It reflects the fact that insurance still does not reimburse for mental illness and addiction in the same way that it reimburses for medical and surgical care, as is required under federal law. I mean, if this were any other illness, we would have been doing a lot more by now. We spent trillions on cancer, and thank God we did. But no one asked when we were spending that money, was it worth it? We all knew as a nation that it was good for us collectively as a nation to lead on biomedical research into cancer. We have not done the same in terms of our neuroscience priorities. And we certainly, in terms of the application of the federal law, never done what we needed to do in terms of enforcement from the provider end to make sure more Americans get access to mental health services as they are today.
Well, Congressman Kennedy, I'm going to ask you to do something that might be challenging. I'm going to ask you to find some silver linings here about what might be happening that might give us some hope for some change down the road.
Well, I couldn't be more excited for where we are. I believe mental health care will be reimbursed service within every public school in the nation within the next 5 years. Mm-hmm. I think if we want to address mental health of our children, which is also at the tip of this pandemic, we're going to need to do that. I think we're going to have mandatory social-emotional learning curricula in every public school in America. I think we're, in terms of criminal justice, I think we're going to have a whole new view of how we view recidivism, and we're going to understand that so many who are in the prison system are people who are victims of severe trauma, and I think if we address some of that, we're going to reduce recidivism, because hurt people hurt people. And if we understand that, we're going to start to treat the hurt so we can reduce the total number of people that are continuing to be hurt in this cycle of violence. I think there's greater neuroliteracy. In other words, I think there's going to be a greater understanding for mental health hygiene. And how do we learn about our brain, our neurobiology, how our thinking affects our acting, and how do we interrupt, you know, behavior by moving upstream? I think all of these things mean that we're really in the golden age of understanding mental health in a whole new way, not just as a mental illness, but really every one of us on the spectrum has from time to time various challenges. And also, what do we do to maintain our mental well-being? So this is not the purview of just people with a diagnosis under DSM. It's really all of us. Mm-hmm. And I think that's an exciting change that I've seen throughout this pandemic, is now everybody's recognizing that they need to strengthen their toolkits to help their own mental health.
Mm-hmm. You know, I was thinking as you were talking about this golden age of mental health awareness, just the struggle that you went through on crafting the Mental Health Parity Act. And I'm just wondering now, you've got the Biden administration in charge. What are the policies that they're going to put into play to increase this momentum?
So we're now looking at all aspects of health. And I really appreciate that the Biden administration has fantastic policy advisors at every level of government. And they understand you got to deal with the social determinants of health. We got to understand the impact of the racial discrimination that so many of our fellow Americans have been suffering from for years, and many times unaware of how that affects them because it's more vicarious. They see people who look like them beaten and killed on TV. And that trauma has never fully been dealt with. We have to deal with it. I think the Biden administration's committed to doing so. But now if we're moving towards value-based care, we're looking at the idea that we wrap services together and we're identifying, do they have a stable place to live? That's going to make a huge difference in their success in managing their mental health and physical health. And so I really think this is the exciting age, because the bottom line is mental health may be the biggest force multiplier that the medical system's never seen before. Right. And once they start to evaluate that the dollar in is worth, you know, four out if they're investing in mental health, maybe we don't want parity because we're going to be getting more than our fair share because people finally realize that this is a part of the system we've never wrapped our arms around. We've never properly focused on quality so that we can actually have expectation that people get better. We've never brought in the value of technology as a remote monitoring device to keep people like myself who have a both mental illness and addiction a better able to monitor that like a Fitbit, right? We're now able to take facial recognition with the telemental health and assist clinicians in being able to better diagnose us. We're going to be able to take voice recognition and modulation and tell where we are on a mood meter. We're not going to be casting people out into the hinter world when they leave the doctor's office. They're always going to remain connected. And for people with a pernicious illness that's constantly looking to take people down, such as addiction and mental illness, this new environment is very conducive to the kind of wraparound care that we ultimately have always wanted.
I want to say that storytelling is so important in healthcare and in policy and politics and every place else. But I'm really curious, your book, A Common Struggle, really is very personal, talks about your own family struggles. How have your public revelations and those of other well-known people shifted the narrative around what we know is truly a family disease, but for a long time was the family disease that nobody talked about?
So we know that if we intervene on stage one cancer rather than stage four, we have a much better shot at saving someone's life. And that's true in mental health and addiction. The earlier they intervene, the better results. But unfortunately, our MO is we wait till someone has a stage four illness before we actually treat. And that's exacerbated by the fact that we want to keep these illnesses secret, which keeps people sicker than they ever need to be. And the real change we can make that can dramatically change outcomes is by understanding that these are illnesses, that we can treat these illnesses. And the key to it is getting rid of the shame, the stigma. And I've been really after ending the discrimination because I'm not sure we're ever going to get rid of the attitudes towards people who have these illnesses. Because let's just be honest, it's in our human nature to judge others, not remembering that no one in their right mind would act in those ways if they were healthy. And when someone is getting up every day and feeding an addiction of any kind, they're jeopardizing their relationships with their loved ones, their employers, even their freedom. So they're being held hostage by their illness. And I like to think of mental health care providers as those 911, you know, special response force that go in there and help kick down the doors and bring people back into the light. And we're only as sick as our secrets is this refrain in recovery that we use. And it's very true. And our country has been sick because we've collectively been keeping this quiet and we have to open up. The problem is, how can you expect Congress to do more if they're not hearing from us? Mm-hmm. And if because we're feeling shamed, then it's easier for them to overlook our interests in favor of other interests of people that are much louder. So if we want to see things change, we have to start in our own lives. And we have to be more open about discussing these things so that we can see more people helped.
We're speaking today with former U.S. Congressman Patrick Kennedy, founder of the Kennedy Forum. I was struck by your saying early intervention is the key.
Well, my wife is a public school teacher, veteran of the classroom, sixth, seventh and eighth grade for 14 years. The story she tells that she knows which kids need help and she has no tools as a teacher to help them. They're crying out for help. And the best thing she can do is send them to the principal's office. That has to change. I believe the back to school money, $130 billion has been set aside. Mental health is, quote unquote, optional. The Kennedy Forum, led by my wife, Amy, really wrote a letter to the Department of Education. We're expecting to get a letter back from them shortly recommending series of evidence-based interventions that we can pay for in this narrow, finite time. There may be things that we could do to bridge these local school systems into an ongoing, continuous funding for school-based mental health. And if we can tie that to Medicaid and get waivers to reimburse for school-based telemental health. We couple that with social emotional learning. Education today cannot be done without having mental health, social emotional learning, coping and problem solving skills all baked into the day. I just see this as, again, a real historic opportunity for us to change how we define education and not segment it away from mental health or healthcare, but combine the two.
So I want to talk about another dimension of this that we haven't really touched on. Love the clarion call for a behavioral health provider in every school. Where is this workforce coming from? We've talked about the need to really educate and train, clinically train, a whole new generation of behavioral health clinicians. And some will be peer counselors, mm-hmm. but a lot of people need the full training, licensed independent providers. Is your institute and your work focusing in on that next generation of behavioral health and addiction workforce at all? And if so, share with us what you see as some areas of promise.
Yeah, so I'm really proud to say I co-founded a company called PsychHub. And PsychHub is in this space. It's about educating all the behavioral health providers to practice in an area of specialty so that we could get payers to curate providers based upon those diagnoses that they treat, rather than being one size fits all, single shingle providers that treat depression in the morning and eating disorders, you know, later in the day. We want to have the kind of personalized medicine that we expect in the rest of healthcare. So PsychHub trains behavioral health providers, it trains regular medical clinicians, because frankly, you know, if you're a cardiologist and not dealing with depression, you know, and you're having a post heart attack patient is four times more likely to die of a heart attack if they've got underlying depression. Okay. I mean, it's all interrelated. We have to do a much better job at certifying kind of expertise amongst those who are professionals, but also amongst everyone else, because it will be some time before we get the workforce up to speed to carry us to meet the need that's out there. Right now, it should be all hands on deck. So not only do we repurpose the primary care system, but let's repurpose the specialty system. My sister had cancer. They never even thought of treating her for depression and anxiety. As to her oncologist, that was not in his training whatsoever. That's wrong. That's got to change. Frankly, there's nobody that can't benefit from some mental health ally kind of training. Mm-hmm. And as we move to this 988 system, which is going to complement our 911 system, it's going to be even more important that we have kind of EMTs for mental health in every community.
We've been speaking today with former U.S. Congressman Patrick Kennedy, founder of the Kennedy Forum and advocate for mental health parity and equal access to care. You can learn more about his vitally important work by going to patrickjkennedy.net or thekennedyforum.org. Follow him on Twitter at PJK for Brain Health. Congressman Kennedy, thank you so much for continuing to be a tireless advocate for mental health and addiction parity and for joining us again on Conversations on Healthcare.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you both for all your service.
That was an excerpt of the Conversations on Healthcare podcast, which is produced by the Community Health Center of Connecticut and hosted by Mark Maselli and Margaret Flinter. Coming up next, Tom Ezern.
On Prairie Public Primetime TV tonight,
Dr. Henry Louis Gates Jr., Harvard professor, literary critic, filmmaker. He brings a singular passion to his historical journeys on PBS. Join us as we honor Dr. Henry Louis Gates Jr., Uncovering America.
Watch Henry Louis Gates Jr., Uncovering America, tonight at 7 Central, 6 Mountain, on Prairie Public.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by North Dakota Living, celebrating more than 65 years of featuring the great people and places of North Dakota and proudly serving the members of North Dakota's electric cooperatives.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg, and many a small town newspaper across the state of North Dakota has a little feature where you can read about who came to town and what they ate. It's not exactly hard-hitting journalism, but as we hear in this Plains Folk essay by historian Tom Ezern called Country Correspondence, there's a time and a place for that kind of reporting.
Sunday morning, the Madsons, along with Melody and Mackenzie Madsen, joined Paul and Carrie for breakfast in Devil's Lake. Following breakfast, Carrie and Paul went to Dave and Linda's home, where Paul did some work on the air conditioner and got it going just in time for the warmer days ahead. Larry, Levi, and Bo were at the Ludden Cemetery this weekend, mowing. John Hansen came by and did the trimming. Would you like to help keep this looking as good as it does now? Contact anyone of the cemetery board with your offer. Barb Eversick and Jan Lowe were at New Rockford Cheyenne School on Monday morning to help the art department get their kiln up and running. Jan and Barb enjoyed lunch at the cafe before heading home. Beverly Bjornson enjoyed a chat over pie and coffee on Thursday at Margie Anderson's home. And there you have the news from Oberon, Guelph, Cheyenne, and Pleasant Prairie, respectively, brought to you by the country correspondents of those rural communities. Country correspondents were a big part of the newspaper scene of past generations on the prairies. Often when I talk here about historical doings at the grassroots, the box socials, the literary meetings, card parties, picnics in the grove that vitalized life when things were more local, my sources are the writings of country correspondents. Such homely writers, however, are now an endangered species. From the time of settlement onward, there ensued a complex process of sorting out the communities on the land. Newspapers were key players in this process. Just as businesses appealed for custom across the countryside, newspapers sought readers. The newspapers resided in country towns of some standing in the emerging society. To solidify a reader base in the surrounding countryside, they engaged country correspondents. The country correspondent agreed to report the doings of people in his or her little post office, schoolhouse, or country church community for the town newspaper. In return for, not much if you are of a commercial frame of mind. Seldom did money change hands in the exchange of news. The correspondent likely received the newspaper free and perhaps a Christmas gift from the editor. The intangible rewards were much greater. The country correspondent acquired a certain status by virtue of being in the newspaper every week, as well as by deciding who else would be. He, or more likely she, gained satisfaction from conferring the blessing of print on the community and its members. Most of all, I think, there was a declaration of identity implicit in the enterprise. The country correspondent declared, week after week, "Hey, you drive through here and may not see it, but we are a community out here. We have a name, and we care about one another." I read a number of country town weeklies, and it is clear that country correspondents today are only a stubborn remnant of their once mighty guild. Some of this has to do with the consolidation of media ownership, more of it with the decline in rural population, and also the passing of an older, literate generation. We should do more than note the passing of the country correspondents. We should consider their place in our history and perhaps our present. I would love to know about and meet some long-term country correspondents, and would welcome word about such. We would have things to talk about, I'm sure. I'm easy to find and contact.
Dr. Tom Easern is a distinguished professor of history at North Dakota State University. Dakota Daybook is next.
Early automobile trails in America included the 1914 Red Trail that extended from Seattle to New York City. The Red Trail became Highway 10 in 1927. And today you can still drive a section of that original route in the Old Red Old 10 Scenic Byway between Mandan and Dickinson. You can enjoy a pastoral country drive and the small town amenities in New Salem, Almont, Glen Olin, Hebron, and Richardton. More information about the Old Red Trail can be found online at oldredold10.com or on their Facebook page.
This is Dakota Datebook for June 8th. There was once a terrible virus more feared than the atomic bomb. Thousands of people fell ill. Many died. Children were especially vulnerable, and the public held out hope for a vaccine to conquer the disease. It was polio, once called infantile paralysis. It could paralyze and even kill. Leg braces, crutches, and dreaded iron lungs were symbols of the disease. Over many years, the March of Dimes raised millions of dollars in the fight to defeat polio, led by President Franklin D. Roosevelt, who was stricken with polio and paralyzed at the age of 39. Celebrities such as Lucille Ball, Desi Arnaz, Judy Garland, and Mickey Rooney urged people to donate to the March of Dimes for vaccine research. From 1946 to 1955, polio struck nearly 2,000 people in North Dakota. 95 died. A team led by Dr. Jonas Salk at the University of Pittsburgh developed a vaccine that rolled out for field trials in 1954. About 1.8 million children across 44 states in grades 1 through 3 participated, including more than 6,100 children in Burley, Cass, and Morton counties. Of those, more than 1,600 second graders were given the shots, which consisted of 3 injections over several weeks. The other children got a placebo or were observed as controls. After a year, Salk's vaccine was deemed a success. "Serum whips polio," proclaimed the Bismarck Tribune in a front-page headline with an exclamation point. Vaccination clinics were set for the days ahead, but North Dakota's vaccine shipments were initially delayed. Later, some of the state's first lots were recalled by the manufacturer for further studies. Nearly 2 months passed after news of the vaccine's success before the first clinics were held in North Dakota. Burley, Cass, and Morton counties were given priority because of their participation in the field trials. On this date in 1955, with enough vaccine available to immunize eligible children, vaccination clinic schedules were announced. The long-awaited day had come. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Jack Dura. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
That's it for this Tuesday edition of Main Street. Coming up tomorrow on the show, the book Mercury Rising, John Glenn, John Kennedy, and the New Battleground of the Cold War. The book spotlights John Glenn's unpublished handwritten notes and new sources to explain America's space history and our current challenges in space. That's coming up tomorrow on Main Street. Until then, enjoy the rest of your day.